Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, the fiction writer Edward P. Jones. Jones's first book, The Collection of Stories Lost in the City, won the Penn Hemingway Award and was shortlisted for the National Book Award. It focused on the African-American working class of Washington, D.C. in the 20th century. In 2004, Jones won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his work, The Known World. Set in pre-Civil War Virginia, the novel earned Jones another nomination for the National Book Award. His second collection of stories is his third book, All Aunt Hagar's Children. It returns to Washington, D.C., the city that inspired Lost in the City, as well as to many of its themes. Join me now for Edward P. Jones on the Archive Project. Here he is, speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2005.
I'm going to apologize for having to read much of this, but if I attempted to talk extemporaneously, I would fall into a tremendous muddle, and we would all be unhappy. I'm going to cover some of the ground that was covered in the introduction, but that is also something that I can't help. The Known World began with an image of a dying man. It came to me sometime in 1991 or 92, not long after I had completed my first book. The completion of a book of fiction, I've discovered now for the second time, leaves a kind of creative emptiness, and that hungry mind begins searching the universe of what you know and what you can imagine for something to fill the emptiness. And it so happened about this time that I recall one small fact from my early years at Holy Cross College. This fact, as I remember, stood alone, a one-line footnote in a book, or maybe even a passing comment by a professor. The fact was that there had been black slave owners in America. There was no background to that fact, no book about it, or even a chapter in a book, no full period lecture by a professor, just that one plain and simple fact that once upon a time there had been black people in America who had owned their own kind. I began in 91 and 92 then to think I might want to write a novel about that world of a people who chose to participate in a system that was oppressing their own people. I also remember from my time before college, when I was about 16 or 17, that I had read a rather thin paperback book about an American Jew who, having fallen far off the track that was his proper and good life, joined the American Nazi Party, without, of course, divulging his past. I had been fascinated, to be sure, that someone would choose to throw in with people who, if they had their way, would annihilate him and his people. I don't remember the man's name or all that happened to him. I do recall feeling a sadness about the whole matter, and I felt somewhat the same when I discovered at Holy Cross that there had been black slave owners. So this hungry mind set out to write a first novel. What I knew about slavery in the United States is what the average educated American knows, I suppose. Some of it comes from books, and some, perhaps too much, comes from movies and television. I did know enough about myself and about what stands as good writing to know that it would not be enough for a novel that might run to 300 or more pages. So I set out in 91 and 92 to educate myself about slavery. I already had about 30 or so books on the subject, and I bought some dozen more. The books covered a variety of subjects: family life in slavery, slave revolts, the economics of slavery, narratives from former slaves collected during the Great Depression. There were also three or four books on black slave owners, books I had bought sometime in the 1980s, long before the idea of a novel came to me. I don't remember the first book I started in on, but I found it all rather uninspiring. I believe that was because I was reading not for simple edification, and certainly not for the old-fashioned pure pleasure reading. The reading was simply a means to begin building a novel. I had a goal, that of writing the novel, and to get there I had to go through this forest of reading. My heart was not in it, and after about 30 or so pages, I stopped. I did manage to take several pages of notes, facts about what work slaves did beyond working in the field, blacksmiths, seamstresses, carpenters, etc. But I had no heart for any more reading and put the notes away and returned that book to the shelf. Periodically, over the next several years, beginning in 93 or 94, I would go back to the bookshelf. I never again picked up that first book, but chose another, The Negro in Virginia, a book on slavery in that Commonwealth put together by people in the Works Progress Administration. But I never finished that book either, for the same reason. I had no heart for all that research. This is all, it's all very curious to me, because I'm not a person who sort of sits around and contemplates himself. But year after year, I would take, and it happened for maybe 5 or 6 years, I would take this book, The Negro in Virginia, down, and I got through the 40 pages, and I just stopped. I never took any notes. I'm not sure why. And I would put the book away. And the next year, because I hadn't taken any notes, I had to read the same pages again. I would get to about the same point, and I would stop and put the book back on the shelf. And the next year, I did the same thing. I do remember those 40 pages. There were, I think, two facts, and I ended up putting those in the book. One was that in 1806, the state of Virginia passed a law that said all freed slaves had about a year to get out of the state unless some white benefactor appealed to the legislature. And I also came across in those 40 pages that I think in the first or second year, when the law was still fresh, exceptions were made for a black barber and a black baker, both of whom had mostly white customers. This is all the research I did for the known world, those first pages from The Negro in Virginia. This is all the research from that first thought in 91 or 92 about the dying man until I sat down to write the novel in earnest in 2001. I never went back to those pages of notes from the very first book. By the time I got down to writing, I did not want to decipher notes from nearly 10 years before. Some of those pages, I concluded, might not even make sense now that I was no longer the man who had written them. And of course, I never got around to reading any of the other books. I'm not altogether certain why I felt no excitement about doing the research. It might be that at heart, I'm just a fiction writer and not a historian. The facts I need are in the imagination. The facts and the truth of a world are what I make up. One strange thing, perhaps the strangest, is that while I spent some 10 years avoiding all that research, all those 40 or more books, the creative part of me was working away, month after month, year after year. That hungry mind that needs to create used the seed of the image of the dying man, of Henry Townsend, and went on without me, the person who did not write because they felt he needed to first read those books. In my imagination, I saw Henry Townsend as the owner of some 33 human beings. He is a black man, and he is lying on his deathbed. He is 31 years old, young even for the American year I was going to put him in, 1855. In the room with him were three women, and the job the creating part of the brain had for itself was to show over the next 300-plus pages how the four came to be in that room. It was, of course, not an easy job, but it was far easier and far more pleasurable than reading 40 books. I don't have people that I share my work with, but in those first weeks of writing, a friend of mine who is a great reader of books and knows literature when she sees it, she wanted to know what I was doing. So I gave her the first 10 pages or so, and she didn't have a great many comments to make, but one thing she did say was, in this part of, that I'm going to read here, Henry is dying, and in the room is his wife, Caledonia, and their teacher, Fern. Well, in the moments as Henry is dying, Fern and Caledonia are discussing a Thomas Gray poem, Elegy written in a country churchyard, which is one I came across when I was a freshman at Holy Cross. I think it went off, this discussion between Fern and Caledonia went on for about two paragraphs or so. It wasn't very long. Anyway, my friend Marcia comes back to me and says, well, it all sounded rather highfalutin. And I didn't think so, but I had to agree, I had to do something about that, so I changed that. I took out all of that stuff about the poem, and I put in instead this paragraph here. And this ended up to be very good, because in the paragraph, there is a kind of switch in terms of who is a slave and who is not a slave. And in a certain way, it was a theme for the entire book. It was several minutes before Caldonia and Fern knew Henry was no more, and they went on talking about a widowed white woman with two slaves to her name on a farm in some distant part of Virginia, in a place near Montrose, where her nearest white neighbors were miles and miles away. The news of the young woman, Elizabeth Marson, was more than 1 year old, but it was only now reaching the people of Manchester County, so the women in the room with dead Henry spoke as if it had all happened to Elizabeth just that morning. After the white woman's husband died, her slaves, Mirth and Destiny, had taken over and kept the woman prisoner for months, working her ragged but only a few hours rest each day until her hair turned white and her pores sweated blood. Caldonia said she understood that Mirth and Destiny had been sold to try to compensate Elizabeth, to settle her away from that farm with its memories. But Fern said she understood that the slave women had been killed by the law. When Elizabeth was finally rescued, she did not remember that she was supposed to be the owner of those slaves, and it was a long time before she could be taught that again. Caldonia, noticing her husband's stillness, went to him. She gave a cry as she shook him. Loretta, the maid, came in silently and took a hand mirror from atop the dresser. It seemed to Caldonia, as she watched Loretta place the mirror under Henry's nose, that he had only stepped away, and that as she called loudly enough to him, put her mouth close to his ear, and called loud enough for any slave in the quarters to hear, he might turn back and be her husband again. She took Henry's hand in both of hers and put it to her cheek. It was warm, she noticed, thinking there might be yet enough life in him for him to reconsider. Now, that section, while it was written in my head, was years and years away from being put down on paper or computer page and anyone could read. I felt I did not deserve to physically write even one word of the book until I had done all the homework, all the research. I did manage in those 10 years to treat myself to 12 pages of writing on the computer. I believe the writing of those pages were born of a need to actually see something physical in black and white on the page. But those 12 pages were all. There were 6 pages of the opening chapter leading up to Henry Townsend dying, and 6 pages of the final chapter. I never wrote anything else but those 12 pages, not even one line on a 3x5 card. The novel is 388 pages, but the creative part of my mind worked away and was able to hold more than 370 pages of the novel. Not everything in my head was written in detail. Much of it was scrawled across my brain in a very general way. And it was scrawled as I waited for the bus or the subway. It was scrawled as I shopped up and down the aisles of the Safeway. It was even scrawled as I read the New York Times or watched television.
You're listening to a talk by Edward P. Jones. He spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2005. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. We'll be right back with more from Edward P. Jones in just a minute. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. This time, Edward P. Jones. Now back to his talk in Portland in 2005.
So after 10 years, it came to be Christmas 2001. I was then working at home at a nowhere job summarizing newspaper and magazine articles, op-eds, editorials, and columns on taxes, insurance, and taxes organizations. I was becoming unhappy that so much time, 10 years, so much of my life had gone by, and I had only those 12 pages to show for it. I didn't count the work that was in my head. It was real, it was there, but it wasn't something I could hold in my hand and perhaps show the world if the world ever came calling. I had about 8 weeks of vacation time with the day job and decided to take 5 weeks and really dig into the research. I think Christmas was on a Monday, and I was in earnest. I was determined, and I got up, and there were two shelves of books, 40 books, and I knew that I would spend 5 weeks vacation reading maybe 15 or so books, and I still wouldn't be anywhere near to writing the novel. So I didn't do any research. It occurred to me that if I was to make use of the vacation time, I should simply start writing some of what was in my head. Those 6 pages of that first chapter gave me a good head start, and by the 8th of January, 2002, I had written in physical form about 75 pages of the known world. The 8th of January is important because that afternoon, a guy from the day job called me at home on vacation and told me that I didn't have a job anymore. I was less than a month shy of having been there 19 years. They gave me 2 months severance for the 19 years. The day job had given me the used computer on which I was writing the novel, and before they would give me any severance, I had to promise to return the computer and not to sue them. I waited until the very last day to agree to this. For nearly 2 weeks of writing, from the first days after Christmas until the 8th of January, I had developed a relationship with the computer. I got up each morning of those days, turned on the computer, and it never failed to show me all the work I had done the day before. And it never failed to allow me to complete the 5 or more pages I set as my goal each day. I was not a computer person, and I was terrified at the thought of having to give up the machine to learn to work on something else, which is why I waited until the very last day to send the form agreeing to their terms for severance pay. In the end, they never came for the computer, and they sent it 2 months severance. I struggled on and managed to finish the first draft of the novel by about mid-March, less than 3 months after I began. I'm learning, because I'm not the kind of person that sits around and thinks about himself, I'm starting to learn things just in by way of the questions that are coming at me. About a month ago, I had been on the road and I returned home, and it was Thursday, it was about 8 o'clock, and all I wanted to do was plop down on the floor. I moved back to Washington last April, so I've been there a year, and I had furniture when I moved, but it was 21 years old, so I threw it away. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a lot of time, so I haven't been able to get furniture. So when I return home, I plop on the floor, and I sleep on the floor. They always ask me, well, all these prizes and everything, have they changed your life? Well, if my life had been changed, I wouldn't be sleeping on the floor. So the phone rings, and I suppose you have the problem here, these people calling you and trying to sell you stuff. I was in this apartment for 21 years in Arlington, Virginia, and every now and again somebody would call me, and I was on the ninth floor, would call me and ask if I wanted to hire them to sweep my chimney. So the phone rings, and this woman says, "This is Edward Jones," and I say, "Is this a telemarketer?" And she says, "No, it's Oprah Winfrey." Wasn't a secretary, it was her. I guess she dialed a number herself. They don't do that anymore. It's punching now, huh? And we proceeded to have a conversation for about 35 minutes. Most of what she wanted to know was what was real and what was not real in the novel. And question after question, I just kept saying, I made it all up. But after we had spoken and after I had gone out on the road again, about 2 weeks later, I began to realize that the 10 years of thinking this novel through is probably what saved me after they took my job away. When you grow up in certain circumstances, a job is very important for you. It sort of holds you to the world, holds you to the rest of humanity. And when you don't have a job, then you feel as if you're floating out there alone without any kind of support. I think now that if I had not had this whole novel written out, and mostly in a general way in my head, I would have gotten up on Wednesday because the guy called me on Tuesday, so at 4 o'clock. I think I would have gotten up on Wednesday and been in a very depressed state. But I had a plan, a 10-year plan in my head. And I was able to, at Tuesday, I wrote 5 or so pages. And on Wednesday, I was still hurting. I felt very bad. But I got up and I turned on the computer and I did the 5 or so pages again. And for the rest of, most of the rest of January, I did. I kept writing. Sometimes it was even more than 5 pages. I have a calendar where I kept note of my progress, the pages I did each day. And it was only towards the end of January where there were days when I did no work. And it wasn't really related to not having the job. There's some days, even when you have a plan, the mind doesn't respond. I was never certain of what I had written. I was never certain of what I had. I had written the book with no other reader in mind but myself. I'd always believed that one cannot write with any faith in yourself when you write according to what some reader in Dubuque or Albuquerque might like. The reader I tried to satisfy day after day was myself, but who was I to say what I had produced, that it was any good? We are all, in the end, capable of bad taste at any time, especially when the dominant voice we hear is the one in our head. As I wrote the book, I was guided, for the most part, by two things, the unadorned poetry of the Bible and the sound of my mother's speaking. I had gone to graduate school at the University of Virginia at a time when I published only one short story. In working toward a Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing, I was fortunate to take one academic course that I perhaps treasure more than all the other courses. It was the Bible as Literature, given by Dr. Nierenberger. I had never read anything but snippets of the Bible. I had never sat down and actually read it from cover to cover. The Bible as Literature course not only introduced me to the people and stories in the work, but it showed me a poetic and repertorial mode of writing. This Jerusalem Bible, which is far from the stiffness of the St. James Version, offered writing about horrendous events that wasn't cluttered with the kind of emotional language that begs the reader to feel but rarely think. If the story of a people is tragic in itself, then the telling of that story will produce the emotion on its own for any reader with a heart. I can still remember coming upon the moment in the Bible when they throw the prophet Jeremiah down a well. I had at that point come to know Jeremiah, come to know what he was trying to do, and that report of him being tossed down the well grabbed and touched me. And the author had done very little beyond reporting the facts of the situation, the facts about the man. The other voice guiding me as I wrote was that of my mother. I had grown up hearing her speak with a certain cadence, a cadence born of the South. Southern people come into the world knowing how to tell a story, and they tell it with a language that is so often poetic, a language of stories within stories. A Southerner cannot tell you a simple story of a family moving from one place to another on a straight road without informing you about each world the family moved through as they made their way. Now this Smith family, this poor Smith family, with them two murder-in-the-eyes children, got to the place where the old sawmill road juts right past the road they call the bow-legged woman with the dead husband road. Let me tell you how it got that name. And you remind me to get back to the Smith family with them two murder-in-the-eyes children if I forget. My mother's language was full of colorful little sayings, morals, lessons. Each shut eye ain't sleep. Every goodbye ain't gone. A good run beats a bad stand any day. Some families live long lives, but when they go out like popcorn, one after the other. My mother also had a number of superstitions. I remember vividly whenever she combed or brushed her hair, she would take the hair out of the comb and brush and put it in the ashtray. She was a smoker, which is what led to her death in the end. And she would burn the hair. She believed that if the hair ended up in the trash, that birds would get it somehow, and that she would be plagued with headaches forever after. And I was about 3 or 4 once, I remember, and we were walking down 4th Street, and she pointed to a spot on the street, and she said some man had been killed there. I think he had been shot. And she said, it was a sunny day, and she said, well, if you ever come by this way and it's raining, you'll be able to see the man's blood. I never got around to doing that. I wasn't really interested in seeing this man's blood, but that was her belief, is that even decades and decades after someone had died violently, you could go there in the rain, and the rain would show the blood. But all of that, then, it was easy and natural for me to imagine, as I do in the novel, a street in the fictional town of Manchester where 3 boys burst into flames for no other reason than that the universe is a weird place. I can imagine in the novel lightning snaking along the ground, moving about as if it had a mind, choosing to kill birds and trees, but also choosing to run away from a man intent on ending his own life. So it was with the 2 voices, the biblical and my mother's, that I wrote The Known World. I should say that in addition to not reading those 40 or so books on slavery, I also never got around to visiting a friend in Lynchburg, Virginia, and using his county as a setting for the novel. I thought he and I would travel his county in his pickup truck, and I would take notes and go home and inhabit that real world around Lynchburg with the imaginary people I had created. But visiting my friend was something else I never got around to doing. So in those first days after Christmas 2001, when I began writing, I was forced out of necessity to create my own county. I decided to call it Manchester because that had a nice British ring to it. I placed my unreal Manchester County in an area just south of Charlottesville, where I'd gone to school, and just north of Lynchburg, where my friend lives. I called Manchester the largest county in Virginia because the book in my head had dozens upon dozens of characters, and 1,001 things were happening in it. I surrounded Manchester with real Virginia counties because I wanted readers to leave the novel believing that Manchester and its people had existed once upon a time. For that same reason, I invented a multitude of facts about Manchester. And I'll read one more paragraph. The 1840 U.S. Census contained an enormous amount of facts, far more than the one done by the alcoholic state delegate in 1830. And all of the 1840 census facts pointed to the one big fact, that Manchester was then the largest county in Virginia, a place of 2,191 slaves, 142 free Negroes, 939 whites, and 136 Indians, most of them Cherokee, but with a sprinkling of Choctaw. A well-liked and fastidious tanner, who doubled as the U.S. Marshal and who had lost 3 fingers to frostbite, carried out the 1840 census in 7.5 summer weeks. It should have taken him less time, but he had plenty of trouble, starting with people like Harvey Travis, who wanted to make sure his own children were counted as white, though all the world knew his wife was a full-blooded Cherokee. Travis even called his children niggers and filthy half-breeds when they and that world got to be too much for him. The census taker slash tanner slash U.S. Marshal told Travis he would count the children as white, but he actually wrote in his report to the federal government in Washington, D.C., that they were slaves, the property of their father, which, in the eyes of the law, they truly were. The census taker had never seen the children before the day he rode out to Travis's place on one of 2 mules the American government had bought for him so he could do his census job. He thought the children were too dark for him and the federal government to consider them as anything else but black. He told his government the children were slaves, and he let it go at that, not saying anything about their white blood or their Indian blood. The census taker had a great belief that his government could read between the lines. And though he came away with suspicions about Travis's wife being a full Indian, he gave Travis the benefit of the doubt and listed her as American Indian, full Cherokee. The census taker also had trouble trying to calculate how many square miles the county was. And in the end, he sent in figures that were far short of the mark. The mountains, he told a confidant, threw him off because he was unable to take the measure of the land with the damn mountains in the way. Now, this and also a lot of other things similar to this, I've had a number of people come up to me and tell me that they believe the place is real, Manchester County is a real place. How could it not be real if I have all those census figures? I'm not sure why this is, but it seems as if it's too great a leap for a lot of people to believe that you can simply come up with numbers. There's also in it, in the novel, a Canadian who comes to America in the 1870s and makes a living writing pamphlets. And before I was interviewed by the Washington Post guy, he said he had gone on the internet and looked for this man, Anderson Frazier. The novel was all done and my editor suggested that we put some sort of few lines inside, maybe on the opposite of the title page, saying that all the characters were not real, that they were not based on any real people. And I told her, and I tell other people, that there shouldn't be any need for that because on the front of the book, it says a novel. The fact that I did not do any research, that I did not use my friend's county as a setting for the novel, may well have worked to my benefit. Had I read all those books, I would have come upon a million facts about slavery that I would have been tempted to use, and the result could have been a novel where all those wonderful facts would have dominated, and the characters I had imagined would have been pushed to the background. One of the books that I never got around to reading was, and it's nice pictures in it, I did manage it. It came, when I bought it, it had this cellophane wrapping on it, and I did unwrap it and flip through it, and there's nice pictures of houses and everything. But the book was about the architecture of the 19th century, what went into building a mansion, and even what went into building a slave cabin. And this is one of those things that, again, has sort of come to me in the course of being asked questions. But, I mean, I could have read all of that about what goes into making a slave cabin, and I would have been able to maybe have a whole page of all that goes into it. Now, in the novel, in the first pages, there is a slave, Elias, and it's about 9 at night, dark, and he's sitting on a tree stump, and the only light he has is a very feeble lantern behind him near the door of his cabin. He's whittling a doll for his daughter. And I talk about him in the moments when I'm writing about his carving a doll, as well as later on. But I think when I'm talking about him carving a doll, it's the first introduction to Elias. And one of the things I'm realizing is that had I put all that stuff about what goes into building a slave cabin, then Elias and the facts of that would have had to share the same page or pages, and Elias might have gotten lost. I think I'm realizing that my job as this writer, as this creator of Elias, is to present the man in the very best way that I can, and that the intelligent reader can build his or her own cabin. Had I visited my friend in Lynchburg and used his area as a setting for the book, I might also have had a problem. Every fact I used about a real place might have been scrutinized by diligent readers who knew the history of that place. Such readers live to call you on your mistakes. In creating my own imaginary place, I could say whatever I wanted about Manchester County and its people and its history. I could make up census records about it, and in the end, I could tear the county asunder, which is what I did. Some have asked if the novel that was in my head all that time is what finally ended up on the page. For the most part, what is there between the covers of the book is essentially what I had mapped out in my head. There were only a few surprises. In some cases, a story I had created could not fit in the house that I began building when I was writing. There's Elias is married to Celeste, who is also a slave, of course, and she's crippled. Over those 10 years, I had worked out this marvelous story about Celeste and her grandfather, who go out in the rain one day because they have this yearning for blueberries. In the novel as it is now, I say that Celeste was born crippled. But in this story, she wasn't born crippled. She's about 8 or 9, and they go out in the rain, and then there's thunder and lightning. And at one point, a bolt of lightning comes down to the ground and runs along the ground. And I had this nice phrase that we're going to say. It was running like a snake with feet. And the bolt of lightning kills the grandfather. And before he dies, he turns to his granddaughter Celeste and tells her to run. And she starts running. And the lightning, you know, had another phrase that the lightning, still hungry, ran after Celeste. And it grabbed her leg and twisted it. And that's how she became crippled. As I was writing, and I think that's the strange thing, is that sort of what you write in your mind is not quite always the same thing as what you can see on the page. And once I started writing those early chapters, because the story about Celeste and being crippled has to come in the first part of the book when all the people are being introduced. It would not work in the second section. But in all those early chapters, I could not find a place for the story. There's a very long, the longest chapter, I think, it has to do with Elias and Celeste coming together and his attempt before that to run away. And I could not put it in there, in that chapter as well, without unbalancing it. The same thing with all the other chapters. So I didn't use it. Once Dawn, the woman who became my editor, read it and sent it back. She had very few suggestions and comments. And I think she called it at one point a clean manuscript. And I think that's what happens when you work on something for 10 years in your head. But there's a slave in there called Stanford, and I had never. He was a man who spent his entire life chasing after young women, and there comes a point there in 1855 when those women are no longer attracted to him, and he's full of bad liquor, and he decides on this day that he's going to commit suicide, and he's going out into the field to find a place to do this. And just before he does, he sees these two kids in the rain, and they're going to get blueberries. And he decides that, well, I'm going to kill myself. Maybe if I get these kids some blueberries, God will let me into heaven. Stanford was just beaten up, and then he was nursed back to health, and he went on with his life. But once Dawn sent the manuscript back to me, I remember that whole story about the blueberries and the rain, and I use it, and that's what's in the novel right now. One thing I've learned about myself as a writer is that even if I don't use it, I find a use for it somewhere down the line.
You're listening to a talk by Edward P. Jones. He spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2005. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. We'll be right back with more from Edward P. Jones in just a minute. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. This time, Edward P. Jones. Now back to his talk in Portland in 2005.
Another surprise as I pulled the novel out of my head involves some minor people. I had intended that the sheriff of Manchester County, John Skiffington, always be a minor character who takes on a prominent role only at the end. But as I was writing, Skiffington became more and more important. I found that I could not tell the story of that county without putting the sheriff at the center of what was happening. The same thing occurred with the richest white man in Manchester County, William Robbins. I saw that I had to bring Robbins nearer and nearer to the center of the stage, or I couldn't do what I needed to do. And along the way, some characters disappeared altogether because the novel could not sustain them. The insane white lawyer, for example, who pours slavery but befriends and aids the black slave owner, Henry Townsend. There was also a freed slave who was cast out into the world with nothing but a horse that is destined to be killed only hours after the man achieves freedom. Oh, I had this, it was really a nice story about this man. I mean, you shouldn't praise your own poem, but sometimes you can't help it. And it would have run, I think, 6 or 7 pages. He gets out there, and he's on this horse, and it's the only possession he has. He has this he's newly freed, and the only thing he owns in the world is this horse, and the horse steps into a hole and breaks its leg. A man comes along who looks white and tells him, well, you've got a bit of bad luck there, and the man pulls out a gun and says, do you want me to do this? And the freed slave says yes, and the man shoots him in the head. I notice in the novel a lot of horses get shot in the head. There are two that I'm thinking about right now. I have nothing against horses. I just had to tell my story. But anyway, there was this new slave and this man become friends, and it takes him home, and he goes on to live with this man for years and years in a nice and happy life. But again, while the story was written in my head and it made sense where I wanted to put it, once I started writing, I couldn't find a place for it without unbalancing the chapters, any chapter that I would use for it. One other surprise, when it played itself out over 10 years, is how the book expanded beyond my original intent. While the first image I may have had was that of Henry Townsend dying, I'd always thought that I would concentrate almost exclusively on the slaves that Henry owned, some 33 human beings. They were to live in what I was going to call the village, a complex of 16 cabins, 8 on one side of a lane and 8 on the other side of that lane. I wanted to present in that village as wide, as colorful, and as profound a variety of people as I can imagine. I was interested in their masters, Henry and his wife Cardonia, and in all the people in Manchester County, but only so far as they could help me tell the story of those 33 slaves. In the beginning, because I was just going to write about those slaves, I was going to title the novel All Aunt Hagar's Children. Aunt Hagar's Children is the phrase my mother used for black people. But once I got into to the writing of it and everything, as I said, people, especially white people, took on greater roles, Skivington and William Robbins. So I realized that I would have to come up with a title that encompassed all of that. And the library, it just so happened that a few years before I started writing, the Library of Congress bought a map that is said to be the first time that the word America was ever on a map. I didn't know I was going to use that, but I tore it out of the newspaper, and I, when I got to a point in chapter 5, I believe it is, Skiffington is at his jail, and I decided right then to have that map and have it on his wall. In the articles, there's not a lot of information about the map, so what's in the novel is most of it is just made up. And, of course, the legend is my own making as well, the known world. But I suppose that just as the creative part of the mind can't be held back by the more orderly part of the mind that believes it needs to do research first, it can't be confined once creativity began. The more I try to stay just in that village of 16 cabins over those 10 years of thinking, the more I sometimes wandered away, up to the giant house where Henry and Cardonia lived, and up and down the roads of Manchester County. Most of the events in the known world occur in 1855. I began writing the novel nearly 150 years later, when, to be sure, all the characters would have been dead. So much, I believe, would have been different for me as a writer if I had been writing in 1870, some 15 years after the events, or even writing in 1900. Writing so soon after 1855 would have made me a kind of contemporary of those characters still living, even though they would have been living only in my imagination. But writing in 2001 and 2002, I became, and I do not say this in any grandiose way, but as a simple storyteller responsible for all the people I imagine, I became the god of the world I was creating. Every character would be dead, and that meant I knew not only the moment they came into the world, but when and how they left the world. And as the god of that place, that imaginary place, I sometimes found a need as I was writing about people to pause and tell the story of what happened to them after 1855. The characters' lives are all of one piece. The people in the novel may not be able to remember some event of their childhood that were meaning when they are much, much older. Characters may not see how their lives are one piece, but their creator can. And sometimes the creator needs to stop and show how that childhood event came back. The best example of this is, again, with Elias and that doll he fashions for his daughter. He's making the doll in about July of 1855, and several months later, the doll is finished, and his daughter Tessie is walking in the lane, and there are visitors in the lane, and one of them comments on the doll, and Tessie says, "My daddy made it for me." And I don't remember what it was in me at that moment when she says that, but I found myself needing to stop and jump ahead 90 years to that moment when Tessie is on her own deathbed. And it comes into her mind to say, "My daddy made it for me." And she asks her family to find a doll, and they find it in the attic, and they bring it down to her. Tessie wouldn't have remembered that she had spoken the words at 6 years old, even if she had had time before dying. So I have to remember for her and for the reader. I don't think I could have done that if I were writing about the daughter only 15 years after she turned six. That would have been science fiction, which I cannot do. Imaginary history is a different matter. I suppose it is inevitable that a black person writing about slavery would lead to speculation that the writer has some agenda. I know that that is not true about me. I had no agenda. I had no issues I wanted to present. I always felt, from the first words to the last words, that I was telling a simple story about complex people who usually tried to do the best they could, but who often came up short. Had I set out with some agenda, I would have had to slight some characters, present them as either all of one thing or all of another, good or bad, as it were. I could not have shown some characters in all their complexity. An agenda, propaganda, rarely allows for that. People are all things on all days. It would have been so easy to stay with a good man and milk the rest of the scene for some emotional payoff from the reader. But I chose to stay with the evildoer, to try to explain in some small and indirect way how he came to be at that moment in the night. It was harder, because the pull of the story at that moment was with the victim, but staying with the victimizer was so in line with what I was trying to do in the known world. People are all things on all days. Thank you.
That was Edward P. Jones. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2004 for his novel, The Known World. Jones spoke in Portland in 2005 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers in the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time on the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Rand produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.